Captain Felicendelk, Real 3. We were talking about your time on the Jarvis. We've actually dealt with the collision that was the end of that commission. But can we reach back to when you were on a couple of convoys to Norway? Could you tell us a bit about those convoys? What happened?
Yeah, they were quite small and rather slow convoys. But at the end of the second one,
what were you escorting?
Merchant ship convoys. And at the end of the second one, we were told to meet up with a small ship called the Ulster Prince, I think, or Ulster Monarch, I forget which, and to take her up a fjord to a little Norwegian place called Mosjøen, M-O-S-J-O-E-N, pronounced Mosjøen, where there were some French troops, Chasseurs Alpins. And this was towards the end of the Norwegian campaign, which, as you may remember, was a pretty untidy campaign anyway, as regards to British. Anyway, we escorted this ship up this fjord at night, rather fascinating. Dark night, starlit, and Captain Mack, as I mentioned earlier, I think was a tremendous ship handler. And we went up there at high speed and up this narrow fjord. It was absolutely fascinating. Anyway, these French troops embarked in this troop ship, and we took them back, I think, to Versailles, where they disembarked, and we saw no further of them.
Now, the collision actually marked the end. That was in April.
40, it was, yes.
And that marked the end of your service on that ship.
Right.
So what next?
Well, almost immediately, I was appointed to another ship of that same flotilla, HMS Juno, which was identical to Jarvis in terms of performance and armament. And
So also with the 7th Destroyer Flotilla.
Also with the 7th Destroyer Flotilla.
And based at Ibidin.
That's right. And again, we did one or two convoy trips up and down the East Coast without any events taking place until we were suddenly told to sail at full speed for the Mediterranean. So I immediately went off or telephoned my parents to tell them to send me all my white uniform. And we sailed down the East Coast at 30 knots, went into Harwich to fuel, and then straight on round to Plymouth, where we fuel again. And then in company with, I think, three other destroyers, we set out at 30 knots for Alexandria.
Now, were these other three destroyers also from the 7th Destroyer?
No, they were one tribal and two K-class. And so having stopped at Gibraltar and Malta for fuel, we eventually arrived at Alexandria, where, of course, the main body of the Mediterranean fleet was.
And was your role to be part of the escort of the...
Well, we performed all sorts of duties in the Mediterranean. We bombarded the coast of Libya, the Italian positions there.
Tell me about that. What do you remember of that?
Well, there was never any opposition. We used to go into, I suppose, about 3 or 4 miles from the coast and bombard places like Bardia or Sidi Barrani and so forth, where the Italians had had forces. Rather boring, really. One just saw an enormous cloud of dust and so forth when the shells landed. Sometimes we took along with us the Vorspeit, and that was rather more dramatic, because when you have 8 15-inch guns going off, and it certainly raised some dust ashore on the Libyan coast. But we never saw really results of our bombardment, because, as I say, the scene was usually very quickly covered in clouds of dust from the exploding shells.
And there was no counterfire, no aerial attack?
No counterfire, no aerial opposition at all.
Well, what other missions were you on?
We took part in the Battle of Calabria on July the 9th, 1940, when the Italian fleet came out.
Now, what, can you take us through that in as much detail as you remember?
Well, the whole thing was a stern chase, really. The Italians fired a few shells at us. In fact, I got a photograph of one of their shells, one of their battleship shells, landing more or less alongside my ship, but we were never hit. And for most of the time, we were chasing after the Italians, who were making great clouds of white chemical smoke and retiring under cover of it. But they had their big ships and destroyers, destroyers and cruisers. And it was my first experience of really shooting at the enemy at sea in action.
Were you still taking the rate on the director? Or
no, I was at the in charge of the after pair of guns, four point seven inch guns in one mounting, where I had a robust and cheerful guns crew, and it was all rather fun. No particular danger until after the battle, when the Italian Air Force came out and really plastered us.
Now hang on. Can we a bit more about what your job was? In terms of 4.7, did you say?
They had twin 4.7-inch guns, three six mountings, two forward and one aft.
And would you be Y turret? No, not Y, well, X,
I think it was called. But it was the aftermost of the three, and I was in charge of the gun.
And what exactly did that entail?
Well, I didn't have any particular function except to be there and make sure that everybody did what they were meant to do at all.
Where did you get your firing instructions from?
Oh, we got from the central director.
That was all done automatically.
It was all done centrally.
Now, you said that you wouldn't, as a stern gun, you wouldn't be involved in firing at anything at that stage. But what about when the Air Force attacked? What do you remember of that?
Well, they dropped the most enormous number of bombs. We weren't hit, although one officer, I think, was wounded by a bomb splinter, which from a bomb which fell fairly close alongside. But we didn't suffer any damage to the ship itself. It was just an unfortunate splinter from a bomb which hit this officer. It didn't kill him, but it just wounded him.
What was it like during the bombing attack? How did you feel?
Exhilarated, I think. You weren't frightened somehow. It was more exhilaration. I'm not quite sure what the modern term is. You were on a bit of a high, I suppose, is the modern term.
And anything else about the battle, or was that the end of it?
That was the end of that. And we went into Malta and fueled, because we'd been steaming pretty hard. And then made our way back to Alexandria, being again bombed fairly heavily en route. But we arrived back in Alexandria without any casualties or damage to my particular ship.
Now, what other duties were you on with the destroyer?
I used to help with the deciphering of signals.
What did that entail?
Well, the ciphers in those days was a book cipher, and you had one person to subtract the number of numbers and then look up the answer in the cipher book. Nowadays it's all, of course, done mechanically. But it was rather a tedious business and involved being called out in the middle of the night sometimes to help. Usually the doctor was the chair who did the ciphers, because it was a sort of non-combatant job he could do. And I used to sometimes turn out and help him if there was a particularly long cipher which needed to be unbuttoned in a hurry.
Any other duties? Or special
duties? Oh, no special duties, no. No, I was still a midshipman. I was still under training, as you might say.
Now, what else was the ship doing? I mean, did you spend much of your time in harbour, or were you out and about?
We were out a great deal. We went up, we escorted a convoy up to Greece, I remember. And the convoy was attacked by Italian torpedo bombers. It missed, luckily.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I saw this aircraft coming very low down on the water. I didn't know what it was or who it was until I suddenly saw this torpedo drop aimed at one of the merchant ships. But luckily it missed, and unfortunately we didn't shoot it down. We had a go at it, but didn't actually hit it. And it flew off, I suppose, to Crete or somewhere, and that was the last we saw of it.
Were you on many of these convoys?
I can only remember two, I think, altogether.
What was the other one?
Well, again, from Alexandria area up to Piraeus or somewhere like that in Greece. It was when we were reinforcing Greece, but before the sort of debacle which occurred later, you know, along with Crete and the rest of them.
And what about when you were in harbour? What was life like in Alexandria harbour?
Well, Alexandria, I don't know whether you've been there. It's an enormous great city. and full of bars and women and everything else, all the things the sailors like. Once did a good deal of sailing in the harbour, which was quite fun. But there weren't enormous sporting facilities, and I can't remember taking part in any particular sports there, except perhaps one cricket match, but I can't at the moment recall who it was against or what happened.
Well, did you drink at the time, or as a young midshipman, or were you not allowed?
On board you were still only allowed beer or sherry. You weren't allowed spirits.
What about ashore?
I think one drank the local wine. Or one says the local wine, you drank probably Italian wine, I should think. But I hadn't really got a taste for spirits, so I'd never been a whiskey drinker anyway.
Were you warned off women, wine, women and song? You know,
No.
So what do you remember, what's the next thing you recall?
I suppose.
Well, perhaps
taking my examinations for some lieutenant, the seamanship examination.
Tell me about that. What were the examinations?
Well, it was a single examination, both practical and oral, and I took it in HMS Malaya, to which I had gone a few weeks before to sort of swat up on big ship subjects.
So you actually transfer to the Malaya?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And that would be in.
Again, 1940 still.
September 40, and you were just there till November 40, so you'd gone there to do this examination.
That's right, yeah.
And what do you remember of the examination? And
oh, nothing really. It wasn't very formidable. It was, I think you were examined by the captains of three ships, but it wasn't a very formidable examination as far as I was concerned. I knew all the answers. Yeah, we only had one remarkable incident in Malaya. We were off Crete on one occasion, and a sailor lost his nerve in the night and jumped overboard trying to commit suicide. And somebody saw him go, but we couldn't stop and pick him up and risk the lives of 1,000 people because we were very much in enemy waters. And so we kept on. We had a screen of destroyers ahead of us, and after an hour we turned 180 degrees and were steaming back more or less along the track which we'd previously made. And an hour later, after I turned round, a sailor in an Australian destroyer heard a cry in the water, and that was a sailor of ours, and they stopped and picked him up. Rather astonishing, after all that, in the dark, after a lapse of 2 hours, to pass near enough through the same water and pick this sailor up and hear his cry above the noise of the waves. Rather astonishing. They talk about the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. I say that's a good example.
So, what did you think of the Malaya as a ship? It was a much older battleship, one of the first.
She fought at Jutland.
What did you think of
her? Well, I wasn't in her long enough, really, to enjoy her, I don't think. Of course, having come from a destroyer, to get back to the rather formal life in the gunroom of a battleship was a bit of a sort of letdown in a way. They were a pleasant enough lot on board, but I wouldn't say it was my happiest ship. I knew I was only for a short time, but I didn't relate to her terribly closely, I don't think. I knew I was there just to pass the exam and then go home.
But you didn't go back to the Juno, from the looks of it.
No, I didn't.
You went
no,
to
no.
the Ramillies.
I went to the Ramillies purely for passage home. We passed through the Mediterranean and met the Italian fleet on the way and had a skirmish at the Battle of Spartivento.
Now, what do you remember of that? Because that's
practically nothing. We accepted the Ramillies, I think for the first time in her life, fired her forward 15-inch guns, which landed about 4.5 miles short of the enemy. We were miles out of range. We fired them, I think, more out of bravado than anything else. There was no hope of hitting the Italians, who again were retiring at high speed behind smoke, which followed their custom in those days. But the war spite did, in fact, hit one of the Italian battleships. so far as I recall, at some enormous range.
Now, were you actually a sub-lieutenant now, or an acting sub-lieutenant?
I was an acting sub-lieutenant, yes.
What difference did that make to your life?
Well, while coming home, practically nothing. We got to Gibraltar and I changed it there into a troop ship, the Franconia, which brought us back to England. But it was sort of fun to be going home again and nice to have a single gold stripe on one's arm.
So you got back to England around about December?
That's about right, yes. Certainly in
anything about the Franconia? Or?
Oh, no, she was just a large Cunard liner. Employed on trooping duties.
No,
not at all.
So what happened when you got back to England?
Well, then, after Christmas at home, luckily, in the beginning of January, I went down to Portsmouth to start the customary round of specialist courses, which all sub-lieutenants in those days underwent.
Now, where were these courses
well,
done?
Well, they were at HMS Excellent, the Gunnery School, Burnham, the Torpedo School, Mercury, the Signal School, Dryad, the Navigation School, and various things like anti-gas courses and damage control courses, and so forth.
Now, could you? I know it's a bit of a pain, but if you could take us through what each of those courses entailed, or at least the outline of it. What about Excellent, the Gunnery Course?
Well, the Gunnery Course, you learned, did a good deal of square bashing, the intricacies of fire control and a gun drill on 6-inch guns, generally smartening you up, rather. I didn't learn an awful lot about gunnery, really. It wasn't a subject which greatly interested me. But anyway, we got through all right, and I only got a second-class certificate from it, I think.
And HMS Vernon,
Vernon was a torpedo school in which I got a first-class certificate. I enjoyed that immensely. And in fact, in later years, I specialised as a torpedo officer.
Now, what
in those years, of course, the torpedo officers not only looked after torpedoes and mines and things like that, but they were also responsible for the electrics in a ship. And part of the way through the course at Vernon, the Germans started bombing Portsmouth in a very big way indeed. And so the Vernon instructional side moved out to that fine old girls' school, Rodine, near Brighton. And so I did half my course, in fact, the electrical side of my course, I did at HMS Vernon R, as it was called, Vernon Rodine, where there was still that famous notice up in some of the former girls' dormitories, if you want a mistress, please ring. Whether all the sub-lieutenants had their fingers on the button straight away, I don't know. Anyway, there it was.
What was it about the torpedo and electrical work that attracted you so much, whereas gunnery didn't?
Well, gunnery is very noisy, and the number of deaf gunnery officers is quite astonishing. Torpedoes seem to be a more subtle sort of weapon, could inflict rather greater damage in many ways than a gun, and sank ships rather quicker in many ways. Electrics, I thought, probably a good idea to know something about them, not only in the Navy, but also in the civil life when one finally retires. It's not a bad idea to know how to bend a fuse or something like that.
Now, HMS Dryad, was it?
Dryad is navigation school. Well, that was purely navigation. And there were tides and sun sights. And, they had a small warship attached to them, which used to go out and take sights and navigate around the Spithead and the Solent and so forth.
And any problems with that?
No, I got a second, I think, but I didn't specialise in it.
And I forgot what the other one was you said.
Signals, that was Mercury. Well, that was, as you might imagine, how the worldwide radio, naval radio system works. Make sure that you are competent in Morse and Semaphore. I got a second.
But you did all right on it.
Oh, a little right, yes.
Second
yes,
is perfectly
yes.
adequate.
Oh, yes. Mm.
What do you remember much about the Blitz, the Plymouth Blitz? Sorry, Portsmouth Blitz.
I can still picture it. Yes, one was expected to go out and help as far as one could. I think we had tin hats which we put on, but I can remember helping to get old ladies out of their houses and try and saving some of their furniture, which we had just carried into the street because the house was burning. And I remember watching some incendiary bombs hitting a church roof. And there was nothing we could do about it because the church was locked. We watched the whole of the church absolutely go up. Woof, eventually. I was there watching from the street, I suppose, for half an hour. And in half an hour, the whole thing was an absolute flaming bonfire.
Were you actually helping rescue people, or were you more helping with sort of shifting rubble and, you know, clearing rubble?
No, we were helping people, if anything, yes, and looking after our own skins, too. A number of my brother officers were killed in HMS Vernon during the Blitzes. There was a direct hit on one of the sort of control centres in Vernon, which killed about three or four of my colleagues. Our instruction was rather interrupted by the Blitz. If you've been up all night, you tend to fall asleep during lectures. Sometimes we'd walk up the Portsdown Hills and watch Portsmouth burning in one of these big raids, you know, rather than stay there and get fried ourselves. I mean, we had no duties. Anything we did by way of assisting civilians was out of the goodness of our hearts and patriotism. We weren't sent out to do it. We just, you know, if we found ourselves out and the bomb came down, you just rallied round quite naturally.
Anything else about that time in Portsmouth? You seem to have been there till April 41.
That's right. Well, we were based at Portsmouth for all these courses, apart from when we went to Rodine for the torpedo part, or the electrical part of the torpedo course.
Now, the next thing would be when you went to HMS Malcolm of the 8th Escort Group.
That's right.
Now, where was she based?
She was based at Londonderry, commanded by Commander Howard Johnston, Howard-Johnston, who was an anti-submarine specialist of some note.
And what do you think of him?
I didn't get on well with him, in her. I was the navigator of his ship, and she was the leader of the tiller. And I got a good... It was very tiring work. You know, you'd be up all night, in foul weather and everything else, and one got absolutely knackered. Really, almost asleep on one's feet. However, I survived him. We sank a submarine, U-651.
Tell us a bit more about what he was like then. I mean, you know,
I would call him peppery. No particular, no sense of humour at all. A very competent anti-submarine specialist, a good ship handler. But I wouldn't say he was popular in the wardroom. You know, he never came down and had a glass of gin with us, really. He was, he kept himself very much to himself.
Was the wardroom like? Could you give us an idea what the atmosphere in the wardroom was
well,
like?
Well, we were very happy down there, all of us. But he was a very austere sort of chap. He had no small talk. He was a bachelor still. No, to be quite honest, we didn't terribly care for him. Although he was obviously an efficient officer, and he was good at sinking submarines.
So tell us about the wardroom. What did the wardroom offer for the officers? I mean, what did it give you? What were the food and...
Food in the bar, and an armchair, if you were lucky.
What was the food like?
Oh, could have been... Well, it was okay until the fresh veg ran out, and then one was on tin stuff. So it wasn't exceptionally attractive. But you weren't at sea for all that long, and you came back to harbour and had some decent meals in the pub in Londonderry.
Was it a hard drinking mess, or wardroom?
No, one didn't drink at sea.
Not at all?
Virtually not at all. You might have had a beer, but you wouldn't certainly have a glass of gin at sea, except one officer who eventually went round the bend, I think, largely a result of that.
So it was abstemious at sea.
Well, one always was at sea, and both in, at harbour, both in peacetime and in wartime. You don't get pissed at sea. It's not on.
And what about the... how did you get on with the other officers?
I mean, fine. We were part RN, part RNVR. We had an Australian. Splendid fellow.
How did you all get on? I mean, sometimes RN don't get on with RNVR.
Absolutely. Well, you're all in the same boat. You sink or swim together. And there were no rough edges in our wardroom at all. None at all.
Tell us a bit about... You mentioned it was hard work, but what exactly were your basic daily duties as navigating officer? What would you do on a daily basis?
Probably having been up most of the night.
No. Doing what? I mean, if you just explain at each stage.
On watch. On watch for 4 hours at night, certainly. Possibly even 8 hours with a four-hour break in between. And then taking sights of the sun morning and evening, fixing the ship's position, comparing it with what other people thought was a ship's position, because there were no radio aids in those days. I don't know, but one got pretty well exhausted, absolutely knackered.
And what would you say? I mean, can you describe when you were officer of the watch? You as well as being what your normal.
Well, you were keeping in station on the in your station on the screen of the convoy, which might have been 100 ships, and you had to in foul weather, and you had to keep in the right station. You were operating your ASDICs or sonars, they call them these days, the whole time. And you might have to investigate contacts, keep an eye on the convoy to see that they didn't straggle or get out of the other station, that they didn't make too much smoke and give away the position to the enemy if they were watching through a periscope. It was all go in a convoy. There was no sort of hanging around.
And where were the convoys? Which convoys were you escorting?
We escorted them from Liverpool to usually to Halifax, Nova Scotia. Although we didn't go all the way over, we were met halfway over by an escort group of Canadians, and they would take over and take them for the rest of the voyage. So we'd take them to somewhere south of Iceland or southwest of Iceland, and then get relieved by the Canadians.